Welcome to Real Jam Radio. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Daniel LaRue, your host. We have a strong episode for you today. We have Shams Charania of RealJam.com. We talk for about 21 minutes about the first month of the season, and he had some interviews with Derek Fisher and Andrew Bynum, so we go into more depth on those situations. Also talk with Ed Maisonette, who's the editor-in-chief and founder of the Sports Fan Journal, and he's a writer for Slam Magazine. We talk for about 55 minutes on a wide variety of topics. First up is Shams Charania. He's a writer for Real GM. You can check out his author page there. I talk more specifically with him about the pieces that he's written recently with Derek Fisher and Andrew Bynum. He talks with both of them and what he learned from the experience. Hope you enjoy it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yep, no problem. I appreciate it.
So we're about a month in now, and I was wondering what in particular, kind of in a broader sense if you want, has really stood out to you in the season so far?
In the Eastern Conference especially, just how top-heavy it is, how lopsided, you know, a lot of games have been, a lot of the entire Eastern Conference. I mean, you see the bottom, especially after maybe the fifth or sixth seed, there are a bunch of teams below 500, a lot of 2-7, 3-6, 3-7 teams. And then in the West, it's just what it's been for the past decade, just a lot of really stacked teams, and whoever's going to end up 9, 10, 11, I mean, they're going to have a case for being in the playoffs in the East. So just how the parity, just the difference between the conferences, I would say.
If it were up to you, would you prefer a system where the top 16 teams, let's say, regardless of conference, made it in the playoffs?
Yeah, I think that would be more fair, just, you know, giving the best teams a legitimate chance where, you know, in baseball you have wild card. Here, you know, we've had teams in the past finish, you know, with 50 wins and not make the playoffs, 45, 48 wins. And in the Eastern Conference, you're locked to make the playoffs with a record like that. So I would say so. But, of course, this is a system that's been going on for a while now in the NBA.
So you wrote a piece recently on Derek Fisher. It was one of my favorite reads recently. I was wondering if you could walk through that a little bit with for the listeners who might not have seen it yet.
Yeah, I got a chance to talk to Derek recently for a story. Mostly, I wanted to talk about, you know, he signed with the Thunder in 2012, and I feel like a lot has changed since then, just in terms of the role. The team, especially, you know, no James Harden. So he's witnessed guys like, you know, Russell Westbrook, Kevin Durant, just really have a huge change of roles. And then they've had to come together as a team, too. Just being around them, they're as close as ever, the team is. And then, you know, it was interesting on Derek Fisher because this is his final season, so he says to everyone. It was interesting because he pointed out that the team as a whole, there's an understanding that there needs to be a sacrifice, not just on the court, but off the court with their time. And like I told him, I feel it starts with Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook and how they can lead the team in terms of sacrifice. And he said, you know, from years past, Kevin Durant's known as a scorer, Russell Westbrook as a scoring guard, but this year, more than ever, they're looking to do everything. It doesn't matter which facet they want to. It's about just helping the team in whatever area they need help. So that was interesting. Yeah, in years past, he pointed out that, you know, Kevin Durant was, especially when they played the Lakers that season in the first round, everyone on the Lakers viewed Kevin Durant as more of a scorer. They really didn't respect his ability to pass, but now you see Kevin Durant putting up 8 assists, 6 assists, so just he was more impressed by their overall abilities.
In the piece, Derek talks about how this is definitely his last season. Did you get a sense from him of what he wants to do after his playing career is over?
No, I did not. But I mean, you would assume he would have unlimited opportunities either in the front office as a possible assistant coach or in broadcasting. Obviously, you know, he's a very astute guy, very sharp, thoughtful. But, you know, he said it's my last season unsolicited. It's not like I asked him about that. It was more about him pacing himself. And Scott Brooks talks a lot about how, you know, Derek doesn't even need to make a shot. He doesn't even need to, you know, come up with a big pass or anything. He still impacts the game on the defensive end, just with his leadership as well. So I think I think, you know, he'll obviously have an unlimited amount of opportunities, and he made clear to me that, you know, he's not looking to pace himself this season. He believes this is last season, so after that, I think he'll have unlimited opportunities in whatever area he wants to go to.
Yeah, completely agreed. Last week, I think it was, you talked with Andrew Bynum, and it was interesting hearing what he said about the pain in his knees. I was wondering, just from my own interpretation of it, when he was talking about how he didn't think the pain would increase, was that just during his recovery, or is that a more permanent thing? From what was your take from talking with him?
Definitely something he's going through every single day. It seems like the Cavaliers training staff, they've really been pushing him. They've really set up a regimen for him before games, after games, during games. I sort of followed him when I got a chance to see them play. Just before the game, he just goes through this, I wouldn't call it rigorous, but I mean, in terms of how long he spends about over an hour pre-game just shooting mid-range shots. Then they bring him to the low post, and then they do these conditioning exercises with, you know, sprinting, and then they take him back to the locker room. He goes to the training room, gets whatever treatment he needs done to play that night. Then he plays. And, you know, Mike Brown's been adamant that, you know, they're going to bring him around slowly. He started a few games now, but they've limited his minutes, obviously. His knees are, you know, they're shot to a certain extent. He's admitted multiple times, you know, that he doesn't feel like it'll get any better. This is where he's at. And it's just about pain tolerance and finding other ways to make a difference. He's talked a lot of his footwork in other interviews I've read. But with me, you know, I asked him if he felt like this training staff can, you know, alleviate the pain a little bit. You know, just help him in ways possibly the nutrition staff couldn't. And he said, you know, not really, because this is where it's at. The pain is going to be there. But in one area he does feel he can improve as the season goes on is conditioning. And it was interesting because he told me that he feels he could play, you know, 25, 30 minutes a night, you know, something where he wants an increased amount of minutes. But obviously it's smart, it's wise to limit his minutes and bring him along slowly.
They also have the benefit of having Anderson Varejao, so they have another center that can, that they wouldn't really want to play the two of them together. It just seems like you wouldn't have enough spacing. So they can be more flexible with that as long as he's healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, we'll see where this is going to go with Cleveland. It seems like they've been a little bit, obviously they're 4-7, and they've reportedly had a little bit of an issue in the locker room in terms of chemistry. But, you know, we'll see what happens with them. I mean, everyone, management over there, the coaching staff, they all predict, you know, believe that this would be a playoff team. And, you know, what if 30, 40 games in the season, they're still, you know, 5 to 10 games under 500? Do they look to move a guy like Anderson Varejao? So I think, you know, that's a team that's also very fluid right now.
What teams kind of in that big grouping of Eastern Conference will end up making it out and being a legitimate playoff team?
I still think Cleveland can be a legitimate playoff team. I know Washington is 2-7, but I think they have a chance to get in there in the eighth spot. Obviously, Brooklyn's right now toiling in the bottom, and so is New York. You got to see one of those teams make it. And I think a team like Atlanta, which is off to a 6-4 start, I think they have a very legitimate chance. I know I just named like 4 or 5 teams there, but I definitely think Atlanta has a legitimate chance. Everyone's been down on them when they lost a guy like Josh Smith. But, you know, they re-signed Jeff Teague. They brought in a guy like Paul Millsap, who's very skilled, and he's made a difference already for them. They re-signed Kyle Korver, who I think's made something like 81. He's made a 3-82 straight games. So I think Atlanta has a very legitimate playoff chance, even though a lot of people counted them out. But yeah, like I said, it is very top heavy. You have Indiana, Miami, Chicago, and then a lot of people thought Brooklyn would be there as well. But I definitely think it's a very top heavy conference. And even if you make it into the 6th, 7th, 8th spot, you're likely seeing a sweep in the first round.
Exactly. And I think what could end up, we'll have to see how it plays out, but I think it could be a really interesting dynamic in the East that The teams won't know for sure, even by the deadline, who the buyers and sellers have to be, because they might all be so jumbled up. Maybe one or two teams will fall out and one or two teams will move up. But right now there are only three playoff locks in the East. And so those other spots, but I fully expect that we'll see some teams establish themselves as buyers or sellers without knowing for sure. Boston could be one of those. Mm-hmm. New York is obviously going to be a buyer because they don't have their own draft picks. They have zero incentive to lose,
mm-hmm.
and their coach and players and all that. Because the West, I think, you know, the West is going to, you're going to know if you're in the mix or not. You might not know if you're going to make it or not. But in the East, it's going to be like there's no team that can say right now, you know, we can't make the playoffs if we're remotely healthy.
Exactly. I think that's a very strong point. I mean, you look at You look at the East. I mean, it's, you have teams that are 2-7, 3-6, and right now they're a half a game out. And I think that's going to be something where that's going to be going on off season. You have teams in the bottom there. You know, you have Orlando, Charlotte, and a lot of people expect Philadelphia to drop off. It's funny when you just pull up the standings. Philadelphia's their point differential. They're -6.3. I think. You're right, and it's going to be very interesting. You have teams like Boston looking down low, guys like Gerald Wallace, Courtney Lee, and then you have Toronto, which seems like it's inevitable with the new management that they're going to trade either, you know, a guy like Rudy Gay or DeMar DeRozan. And a lot of people talk about Jonas Valanciunas is an untouchable, but, you know, he hasn't had an impressive season so far this season. So, it's going to be very interesting to see what Toronto does as well.
The other big question to me, and it's possible that they'll just wait, is whether Detroit is willing to commit to their having a top three that are all big men in Drummond, Monroe, and Josh Smith. Because if they wanted to trade Monroe, and I'm not saying they do or they should, they would this year would actually be a reasonable time if they wanted to do that.
Yeah, and it seems like they want to see where this can take, where this, you know, big three in the front court can go, how far they can take them. But I think there's a real ceiling there because the backcourt is just dismal in terms of its shooting. I mean, you have Brandon Jennings, who needs to put up 20-plus shots to get his 20 points nowadays. And, you know, Chauncey Billups, he's past his prime, obviously. And then they're unsure about what they're going to do with Caldwell Pope, the rookie. His minutes have been really fluctuating throughout the whole year. So far, you know, it's everything you've got, all the vibes you've gotten out of there is that they want to continue to see where this big three in the front court is going to go, how far they can take them. And I mean, they were hoping a playoff seed, obviously, but you're right. I mean, if they're off to, let's say they're under 5-10 games in February, they could easily look to move on, especially considering he's likely going to leave them in free agency, given that he wants a near-max contract, and Detroit wasn't even willing to consider that when he was eligible for an extension. So it's going to be interesting.
And Monroe's in the situation where I think a couple other guys are. We'll see if Rudy Gay's there too, where once LeBron signs, and we don't know what Bosch and Wade are going to do, but there are going to be teams that have space and want to use it. I'm not sure the Lakers will be one of them, but there will definitely be other teams that feel that it's burning a hole in their pocket. And Monroe, Gordon Hayward, Bledsoe, if like those guys are going to – there's going to be a lot of money to throw at guys. And there's a lot of – like LeBron is a remarkable – he's a franchise-changing piece, as we all know. But that kind of next tier down – I think somebody's going to fall in love with each one of those guys and give them a lot of money, especially the restricted guys, and make it a very challenging decision for the team that has them now.
Exactly, and I think that's what also went into the decisions of, you know, a guy like Gordon Hayward to opt for free agency next summer instead of ironing out a contract extension this year. I mean, from what I was told, the two sides, the Jazz and Gordon Hayward, never even discussed anything close to a max deal. They never talk 5 years. And you look at him going to free agency next summer, and as you said, there's going to be a lot of teams who miss out on the top tier of free agents. And then there's going to be left to pick from those guys, you know, Monroe, Hayward, and then even a guy like Luol Deng. So, you know, it's kind of reminiscent of 2010 when, you know, a lot of, you know, New York, Chicago, they had a lot of cap room. They went for the big guns. They did not get them. And then they had to sell for guys like Amari Stoudemire, Carlos Boozer, eating up a large, large chunk of their cap room for the next 4 or 5 seasons. So I think another team could capitalize on that, but then could also hamstring themselves moving forward with their salary space. But I think that was definitely a major, you know, sticking point for free agents. And then even guys who decided to sign one-year contracts with player options for next year, guys like Nick Young, I know Mo Williams did the same thing. Because these guys are looking forward to this coming free agency, because after the top-tier guys, you have a lot of teams, you know, clearing their cap room, and they're going to have a lot of space. And if they don't, and if some teams don't capitalize, they're going to have to dish out money that maybe they didn't thought they'd have to give.
I think there are going to be a shockingly large amount of bad contracts this summer, and I think you laid out the case. And the other factor in all of it is that there a lot of this ends up coming back to ownership. Like, we saw a situation to me with New Orleans, now the Pelicans, that they were on pace to have a slow rebuild, and they could have done that, but it seems like, from what we've heard, that it was ownership that said, okay, we want to start winning now, and so they had to kind of kickstart that, and that totally changed their timeline, and that'll almost definitely happen for at least one team this summer.
Yeah, and who knows? I mean, a lot of that might be something to do with enticing Anthony Davis. He was just a rookie, but, I mean, the season, it had to be miserable for him. He was a winner here when he played high school basketball. He was a winner in college, obviously, at Kentucky. His first season, it was dismal, and, you know, he sounded like, you know, losing was frustrating for him. But you're right. You know, when they went out and got Tyreek Evans, you get Guus Vasquez. And there are going to be a lot of teams this coming season that, you know, they're going to be in the same predicament. Obviously, you have teams like Utah, who it seems like they're positioning themselves very well for top draft pick. But do they want to bring a guy like Gordon Hayward back? You know, the indications, it seems like people around the league felt that, you know, if the Jazz really wanted Gordon Hayward back, they would have talked somewhere in the 5-year range. But discussions never got there. And then you're also going to have teams like Toronto. If they're going to keep Rudy Gay, is he a guy moving forward who you can build around? He hasn't shown that. His shooting percentages have fallen terribly down since, you know, a couple years ago he had his best season. So, I mean, a lot of teams are going to be in that position where even right now they're not sure which direction they're going.
Makes a lot of sense. What players and teams have you enjoyed watching the most in the first month of the year?
Golden State is a big team. I really enjoy watching Golden State. Just the shooting, the precision that they have on that team. They can kill you from so many different angles. You have Curry and Thompson, and then you have Lee and Bogut down low. And then this year, I'm sure you're much more privy to it than I am down there. But, I mean, they seem like they're really, really keen in on posting up Harrison Barnes a lot this year. And from what I've seen, it seems like he's been deadly as a post-up player this year. Just his turnaround jumper, his face-up jumper. So Golden State is obviously a big team. Minnesota is also very fun to watch with Rubio, Kevin Love. Kevin Martin, who had a down year last year in OKC, didn't quite live up to their expectations, but he's just been balling for them. Los Angeles, the Clippers, when everything's going for them, a lot of those teams are in the West. A lot of the games in the Eastern Conference can drag a lot. You know, watching mostly Eastern Conference teams thus far this year in terms of in person, the games can get really ugly. But you know, you have a lot of, you know, exciting young players in the East, guys like Michael Carter Williams. But you know, a lot of the fun scoring up and down type of play exists in the West. So with teams like Golden State, so I'm sure you're having fun down there.
Yeah, it's been a blast. The Eastern Conference team that I've really enjoyed so far has been Orlando when they're kind of playing the right way. They get into lulls and all of that, but Oladipo is really engaging and entertaining. I went to college with Aaron Aflalo. I've loved watching him forever. And
I've been a big fan of Aaron Aflalo as well, going back a few years now. But
And then the other team to me, the ones that you mentioned are all on that list as well, is Portland. Their offense is just a blast to watch. Their defense still makes me frustrated, but their offense is one of those that it's just really cool. And the way that Lillard, I admit now, I didn't expect
Lillard to improve as much as he already has this year as an older rookie. He's done well. Aldridge has looked very good, though sadly, I mean, there's so much competition for the All-Star game in the West now. That'll be hard. But they're a blast. I'm really excited I get to cover them later this week, so it's going to be a blast to see them in person.
Yeah, the way Damian Lillard and Neil Shea gets he should get a lot of credit for the way, you know, he made the bench over there, brought guys like Mo Williams. Dorian Wright, I believe, is on Portland, too. But, you know, just the way he supplanted that bench, and it's crazy because you went from all this drama surrounding LaMarcus Aldridge to now they're, 9-2, and you don't hear anything about it. And I think that's what winning does. You know, it cures everything. And at this point, it seems like, you know, Damian Lillard, LaMarcus Aldridge are well on the way to being All-Stars this year, so.
The West All-Star stuff is going to be absolutely nasty because there are so many talented players. And then you also get into the dynamics where there are guys who are also talented players, but who, like Kobe could make the All-Star game without having played in many games, though I could argue, I think, that he deserves it just on the aggregate of his work and because he played well last year. It's not like he's a scrub now in any way, shape, or form. And then, it would be interesting to see if, I think he's a very talented player, but if Blake Griffin making it costs somebody like Anthony Davis an All-Star berth, just how that could affect perceptions around the league.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, but we've seen in years past where, you know, players who might not necessarily deserve an All-Star berth, you know, they get it. You know, it reminds me of, you know, Allen Iverson making it in one of the seasons in Detroit, I believe, and then the guy like Grant Hill making it after he was coming off of injury. But, you know, I think there are going to be a lot of players deserving, and the West is always like that. You know, it's deep in that way. You have a lot of, especially in the front court. So, you know, a guy like Dirk, he's off to a solid start. The Mavericks are winning right now. But let's say he's not at that 20 and, you know, 8 range that he usually is at. He could miss the All-Star game, even if the Mavericks are off to, you know, a surprise start. You know, I think guys like Blake Griffin, LaMarcus Aldridge at this point, I think guys like that are locked.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been a blast having you on.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you so much to Shams for coming on. You can read his material on realgm.com. I really enjoy the depth that he goes into, and he does good interviews with players. I learned a lot from his interviews, particularly with Fisher and Bynum recently, but just about everything he does. Next up, we have Ed Maisonette. Ed is the editor-in-chief and founder of the Sports Fan Journal, which is a daily sports and culture publication. He also writes an NBA column for SB Nation called Happy Hour, and he's been a longtime contributor to Slam Magazine. We talk for about 55 minutes to go on a wide variety of things, from the early season successes of the Warriors and the possibilities with the Thunder to the disappointments of the Knicks and the Cavs and a lot in between. Hope you enjoy it. Well, thank you so much to Ed for coming on the show.
My man, Danny LaRue, how you doing, brother?
Doing well. How are you?
Man, I'm sipping brown liquor. I am home on a Monday night, and I'm talking to my favorite man from Real GM, man. Good to be on the show.
Thanks. So we're a little under a month in the season. What has really stood out to you on either a positive or negative end in terms of what we've seen so far?
Well, I'll be a homer. Not the homer that you guys probably think. I don't know if everybody's familiar with my background, but I'm going to be a homer to where I live. And I live in Oakland, California. And one of the things I started to talk about pretty early on was the emergence of Klay Thompson. And I think everybody's really starting to get a chance to see just what Klay Thompson is capable of. And I said early on, I was like, I would be remiss to think that there are a few shooting guards better than Klay Thompson in the NBA, and I think he's definitely got an opportunity to be an All-Star. And lo and behold, now you look up, you know, we're still early, 10, 11 games into the season. Klay's shooting 51% from three-point lane. He's shooting 7 threes a game. He's averaging over 20 points a game. I thought it was interesting in the game versus Oklahoma City. You know, he was really prominent on the defensive side of the ball, taking chances, especially in guarding Kevin Durant, the league's leading scorer. He's got plenty of length to, you know, hold his own against someone like Durant. And also, you could just see, like, Thabo Sefolosha, the Thunder's best defender, he hadn't guarded anybody that had that much of a quick release without hesitation. Klay Thompson would get the ball 18, 19 seconds still with the shot clock, and he's pulling up. And Thabo was just like, what in the hell is going on around here? Like, he's just not prepared. So I think it's helped in stretches, especially when Curry's been off to a slow start. I think I've seen Mark Jackson put Klay Thompson on the second unit, and Klay's been able to buoy the second unit, which has been pretty impressive. And I think defensively, he does not get nearly enough credit for what he's able to do. That's what's made Golden State not just fun to watch, but now people are starting to have this conversation of can they be a finals contender.
Yeah, his defense, I think, has been underappreciated, and I think to a point it's going to continue to be underappreciated as long as Iguodala plays next to him, but I don't think the Warriors care because they'll be so good that it won't really matter.
No, absolutely. And I think, too, it's interesting to see how well Iguodala is netted being a complimentary guy because, like, you know, people were actually shocked when Iguodala was selected for the 2012 USA basketball team. And you know, Coach K perfectly quoted what Andre Iguodala is, and he's a human Swiss Army knife. He can do everything for you on the court. He might not do it great. He might not do anything. I think Andre Iguodala is great at being a great athlete, but if you just were going to give him a grade across the board at almost everything else, he would net B pluses pretty much anywhere else across the board. And I think being on the Warriors now, and I think we were all a little skeptical as how he was going to fit, but he provides such great spacing in being able to penetrate and dip to Curry and Klay, being able to still be a corner three guy. He's like almost an ultimate 3-and-D guy if you really think about some of the things he's able to do. But then defensively, I think he's definitely asserted himself to say, look, and again, I just reflect back to the Oklahoma City game, I can guard Russell Westbrook. I can guard Kevin Durant. I can go and trim and help the second unit. And those guys have been so fun to watch. And now, I don't know if you noticed this, Danny, but yo, Andre Iguodala's kind of been clowning around. Like, I don't mean that in a bad way, but he's having a lot of fun. He's making plenty of gestures after he shoots threes, trying these wild behind the back, you know, passes and fast break, and he's out there mean mugging to the crowd and things like that. And it's been awesome to watch. I'm really happy for him. The further this team gets down the line, I'm just going to continue to be intrigued to see what this looks like at the midway point and how they develop into being a well-rounded team at the end of the season.
I think that playing in Denver as he did was probably fun because of the scheme that they ran, but the Warriors are really fun because of that and also the personnel. I've envisioned that if you're willing to be a complimentary guy, players like Stephen Curry and Klay and Andrew Bogut and pretty much everybody, the supporting players as well, would be really fun to play with because if you want open looks, you'll get them. And if you want to do more, they're generally willing to give you the ball.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you said it right on the head. Like, Andre Iguodala was arguably the best player on the Nuggets. Now on the Warriors, he falls in line as maybe being the third or fourth best player on the team, depending on how you look at the roster. So, and to be fair, like, it's also something to be said about the fact that he's paid. And, you know, some players play exponentially better when they're in a contract year. But other players really play better when they have stability, and they know that for the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years they're going to be taken care of. And Iguodala has that now. And you know, we forget that at the beginning of the last season he was on the 76ers, and the trade happened, and you know, he was on the Nuggets midseason, and now he's in Golden State. So you know, he's literally traversed the entire country from the East Coast to the Rocky Mountains to now the West Coast in the span of, you know, just about a year. So I think he's going to settle in. He's going to continue to get even better.
I think that he's a really good poster child to me of the level of player who they get to kind of a point in their career where they're not old enough to kind of be on the downside, but they know what they want, and he chose the right situation for what he wanted. And I think that's a great thing. He didn't go where the money was necessarily. He went to the best fit situationally.
Yeah, well, I think it was interesting because I think, what, he signed for $4.48 million. With the Warriors, and I think the other offers were $4.52 million from Detroit and $4.54 million from Sacramento. And then you also have to start asking yourself a question. Do I want to be paid minimally more and be miserable in Sacramento, or stay in Denver where it's a rebuild? Or can I shave a few million off and be in the lovely Bay Area and probably recoup that money back? Because everything that Andre Iguodala has said is that he wants to invest in Silicon Valley. And he can do plenty of investing in Silicon Valley pretty quickly, and I think he's already got investors lined up, and why wouldn't they be lined up? And he seems really excited about that from the conversations I've had with him.
That's interesting. I haven't had any of those conversations with him. He also has an owner that has some experience in that as well.
Absolutely. And I think one of the minority owners, if you asked me to tell you his name, I would mess it up. So I'm just not going to say it. But I think one of the minority owners was the VP of engineering at Facebook. And then, of course, when the IPO hit, he cashed out and he immediately bought a minority stake into the Warriors. And I'm pretty sure Iguodala and him have had a few conversations about what's going on in the tech world. So I think, borrowing the words from Clinton Portis, former Washington Redskins running back, Iggy's pocket's going to be straight.
I think that there's a really interesting, I'm not implying anything here, but I think between the situation of being able to get financial advice from people who are plugged in and the Knicks signing J.R. Smith's brother, I think we're on the frontier of things that don't count as circumvention for the cap, but are just kind of like, oh, okay, so this is all right, but other things aren't.
Yeah. And I think that's probably a good transition, because I know you asked me about what are the great things and the not-so-great things that's happening in the NBA, and the New York Knicks are starting to look like Pookie from New Jack City, man. They're looking real desperate out here in these streets. They look lost. They look burnt out. They look decrepit. They look bamboozled and hoodwinked right now. And the fact that I believe, and you might have the particulars of this trade offer that they sent the Celtics, I believe this morning, but I believe they were trying to send Stoudemire and Felton and a pack of jelly donuts and a pack of Black and Miles and a durag from 3 weeks ago over to Boston for Rajon Rondo. And I'm pretty sure Danny Ainge and the crew over in Boston summarily just laughed on the phone and hung up and went on about their merry way. But I mean, I think, Danny, the question I'd ask you is what's really happening with the Knicks right now, just from a roster standpoint, and why is it not working at all?
Well, I think they're a really good example of what happens when you commit to a core and then you don't have a GM or ownership is willing to trade away picks, so you can't build assets. And so what happened with them is that they gave up all these assets to get Carmelo. So you look at the difference between what they did and even what Miami did to get LeBron and any of those situations. They gave up a lot of talent and all that. And they got Shumpert in the draft, he's done fine. I like Shumpert. They don't have a lot of pieces that are coming in that are good. They did well with Prigioni. They did well with Copeland last year, but then they couldn't retain Copeland. So they have this roster, and it's hard for them to add new pieces. And the pieces they have they aren't perfect together. Like, we talked a little bit about how the Warriors, their team together makes sense. The problem with the Knicks is they only have two players who play defense.
Right.
And it's hard to win in the NBA if in a 9-man rotation you only have two guys who play defense.
Absolutely. And now they're trying to trade one of them, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and now they're trying to trade one of them, and the other one's hurt, so they can't trade him.
Right.
So the funniest thing about the Knicks in terms of that, in terms of trades, what I was talking about how they're kind of struck in, is that right now they can't trade a first-round pick. I believe if we're talking about, like, right now, they can't trade a first-round pick any year more soon than 2018, and because of the Stipien rule, and they can't trade it, but then once a draft happens, I don't think they can do it for another couple years. So their asset pool, what they can say, like, let's say they want Rajon Rondo in a trade. The things that they can theoretically give up that would make Boston interested is pretty much just Amon Shumpert.
Right.
Because, I think about the NBA in terms of players who are overpaid, players who are underpaid, and players who are properly paid, with giving additional consideration to when a guy can leave without compensation, and if a guy's going to be restricted, so you can keep him. And every guy on the Knicks, maybe with the exception of Prigioni and definitely Shumpert and Tim Hardaway Jr., all of those guys are either overpaid or properly paid. So it's hard to see them as being particularly valuable, except that some of them are good basketball players.
Right. And I think the conversation is going to begin where someone's going to say, well, I think Golden State, I hate to keep bringing up Golden State, but they're a good example where they're basically like, look, we've got these deteriorating assets that are on the last legs of their contracts. Please take them off their hands so that you can begin tanking for the 2014 NBA draft. And I thought if Boston was going were going to take that trade, I think it would be the best way to say, look, we're not really here for this season. We're all systems go for 2014. But I think from Boston's standpoint, that they look at it and say, well, we can be really crappy and still keep Rondo on our team, and he could be a essential building block for us moving forward. We don't need to make that trade to get that much worse. We probably can still land a top three, top four pick. But I think there's going to be a team that comes along, and it might just be the Knicks standing pat, because I don't know if I can remember a day when the Boston Celtics of 2007 were really bad, and they had Paul Pierce on the roster, and then they decided to trade all of their promising assets to go get Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen. And I can also remember a time where the Miami Heat decided, hey, look, man, Dwayne Wade is not doing well, and we're going to trade all of our assets so we can go get LeBron James and Chris Bosh. Now, to a degree, I guess this is a bit of a flip, but if you say, hey, look, we're really trying to get Andrew Wiggins, Jabari Parker, Julius Randle, Marcus Smart, whoever, and we're willing to eat salary now and even for the next couple of years to assure that we're going to get a top two, top three, top four pick, I think it's actually something to consider, because people think, well, unless they're on expiring contracts, why would you want to do that? But it's not like if you get the number one pick, Andrew Wiggins is going to cost you $12 million. You're getting him at $4 million. And eventually those contracts are going to expire, but you were going to be sorry anyway. And then when that cap relief comes, Daniel LaRue, you might have $20, $30, $40 million of free cap space, and you're just starting to see the emergence of a young player like a Jabari Parker, Julius Randle, or Andrew Wiggins, or Marcus Smart. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm gonna tell you one thing, and it's gonna blow your mind. The Knicks, actually, their pick belongs to Denver unprotected. So
that's right.
That's the fascinating thing, and that's, to me, is the most interesting part about the Knicks, is they have no incentive to tank this year, but next year they have their pick, so they do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when you could see the really crazy stuff. And when you're talking about with expiring contracts and everything, the parallels, let's say Melo opts out, and let's say Melo leaves. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but let's say it is. Basically, every other core piece other than J.R. Smith of the Knicks expires in some form after next season, so the summer of 2015.
Right.
They could completely blow it up for next year and do that exact thing, and there are going to be good guys in that class too. So Jahlil Okafor is, I would say, in the same caliber as maybe everybody but Wiggins in this class. I love him.
Okay.
And so they could do that then. This year, I think they have to go for it because they don't really have an incentive not to. And that's why I think that this season in terms of tanking and all that stuff is going to be really interesting, because there are teams out there, like the Wizards are going to be in a weird stance because they're going to try to make the playoffs because they want to make the playoffs. But as soon as they're out, they keep their pick. So I could imagine them just blowing it all up, firing Grunfeld and doing all that. It's going to be fascinating once we get close. I mean, the Jazz will probably be in the lead by a mile by then, but everybody else could be more interesting.
Well, and that's what makes the lottery a sham and a spectacle at the same time, because a team like Utah, who they're going to get praise for playing young talent, but like I said earlier, it's not like they don't have Andres Biedrins and Richard Jefferson over there soaking up, I believe, 40% of their cap space going into this season, but they're sorry. And you look at the Wizards, and they might as well, you know, we might look back at the Otto Porter pick, and, you know, who knows what they're going to have in that pick. And I think they're going to be drafting for another small forward, unless Julius Randle is there when they pick in the draft, which would be perfect for them, by the way. But they're going to be in a situation where, hey, it's not looking like we're going to make the playoffs. And like, we're going to get to like that 30 or 40 game mark where people are going to start making those decisions. And that's going to be fun. And I'm really excited about it. And I think there's going to be some championships. A championship could swing on it too, because you look at teams like Oklahoma City or Houston or not Brooklyn, but even Miami or Indiana, where they have these pieces that they're probably still a piece away from feeling great about themselves. And right now they feel very good. And one of those bottom feeders could come up come off of an asset and say, look, man, we really don't care about winning. Please just take this guy from us and give us a second-round pick and, like, one of your bench players, and, like, let's make the money work and make it happen. I mean, we already saw Gortat leave Phoenix to go to Washington, and people were thinking, well, Washington just solidified, you know, probably a sixth seed in the East, and, you know, Washington has the second-worst record in the Eastern Conference at 2-7. So I don't know. I'm just intrigued about it, and I'm hoping selfishly that Oklahoma City gets a wing player that is worth a damn, but I digress.
The other guy that, if he's healthy, that I think could swing it, whether it's a trade or a buyout, is Emeka Okafor. Like, if Okafor gets bought out and is willing to take the minimum for a team, that could swing the championship.
No, absolutely. I agree with you. I mean, if he's willing to take the minimum, it's going to sound scary, but I could even see a team like Miami saying, you know what, Greg Golden, it's been real, but let's bring Emeka Okafor to the squad. And it would be so hard for Emeka Okafor to say no. Or you look at Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City would love to have Okafor on the squad. Or even a team like the Clippers. The funny thing is, you would say the minimum, but then it would probably end up being a bidding war. And somebody say, you know, how much can we really afford to give them? And then all of a sudden you have people overpaying for Emeka Okafor, and then that would just be hilarious.
Yeah. A philosophical question. I thought about this with Ethan Sherwood-Strauss when he was on a couple weeks ago. Do you feel personally that the draft should be about balancing talent, you know, like fixing, creating more parity, or do you feel it's more about getting talent into the league and parity doesn't really matter to you in terms of designing it?
There are organizations that have proven to be futile in assessing talent. I think the Los Angeles Clippers is probably the best example over the past 20 or 30 years or so. But then you see teams like, of course, like the Spurs, where they've proven that it doesn't matter where they're drafting, they're going to be able to find talent that can help them win championships. I think that the lottery, it is, you know, it's if everyone's shooting the same bow and arrow, and some people struggle and things like that, then I think the lottery could be a good thing. But when you're gaming the system, it feels like someone's cheating. But I've also gotten to this point now where I enjoy seeing how terrible some teams can be, because the Utah Jazz are terrible. But then I look at the Philadelphia 76ers, and they're somehow 5-7. And Daniel LaRue, if the playoffs started right now, they would be a 4 seed in the Eastern Conference, which is just fine to be awesome. But to answer your question, you know, I'm a nerd a bit, and I kind of I am an appreciator of, like, you know, English Premier League soccer. And I see how these other leagues where there's, like, hey, look, man, you pay to go to the highest bidder, right? And that would be a great and a bad thing for something like this season. Could you imagine if Andrew Wiggins went on the open market? His contract would probably command $200 million on the open market right now. And, like, the bidding war could get so absurd that it would be, like, unfathomable, and that would just be awesome to see. So, but then, of course, we would have what happens in the Premier League. You'd have, like, 5 teams of power and 25 teams that are just bottom feeders, right? So the lottery is probably a good thing. It's probably the best option we have. I don't really have a great way of fixing it. I know some people love Bill Simmons' idea where you turn the lottery into, like, a bit of, like, or the – you know, the people that don't make the playoffs into a bit of a playoff on its own, and where the best team, the team that has the best record that missed the playoffs, gets the best record, so there's still a reason to be competitive. I think that'd be interesting, but unfortunately we don't deal in an NBA that's very liberal on those types of things, and I think this might just be the best thing that we have.
To me, in terms of, I like your hypothetical of Wiggins on the open market. To me, the way that you fix that is actually a way that they've established in the NFL, though they haven't done it really that way, is with a hard cap. Because if you have a hard cap, then you can't have an English Premier team that gives a transfer fee for, like, Gareth Bale. Well, for, like, that's not EPL, but it gives for Gareth Bale or whatever. And so that would prevent that process. But I understand, though it frustrates me to no end, that the players who have no representation in the Players Association are guys who are not yet in the league.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, the Players Association has consistently taken a stand that the most important people in terms of the CBA are the rank-and-file NBA players. So the people who lose the most are max-caliber guys and rookies. They're the only two groups that are systematically – not rookies, but young guys – that are systematically underpaid. And – you could fix that, but the question is, who's going to make it that way? Because I think, and if you want to talk about the way that you stop super teams in the NBA, it's by changing the max salary structure. Because if you make it so that a guy can only make 30% of the cap, they're going to go together, because why else would you do it? If you can't make more money, then you might as well have more fun.
Right. Well, yeah, and I think it's a great point. But, you know, if you took the numbers of the elite, the upper crust, which you're talking about maybe 10 to 15 players that really can – I'm not even saying deserve a max contract, but the people that can get a max contract, you've got maybe, what, 12 to 15 people that can get that, and then you've got the other side of the people just entering the league, which are now subject to the rookie scale, right? So you're talking about maybe 5-10% on the back end, and you're talking about maybe 3% on the front end. So yeah, you're right. Like that middle class, the middle class is dominant when it comes to commanding, you know, pay scale and things like that. Which the funny thing about that is, America with the, I would say, democratic liberal America would love for the world to be, love for America to be like that, but that's a totally different conversation on a totally different podcast on a totally different day. But yeah, I mean, I just think that that's just kind of the way it is. And so you know what, Danny, I will say this. The only thing that scares me about the draft is that you sometimes get scared to see potentially great players go to teams that you just don't want to see them on. And I hate to say this, but I hated to see Trey Burke go to Utah. Not that I have anything against Utah, but I really wanted to see Trey Burke go to somewhere where I could see him potentially flourishing and growing. But I say that then thinking about Kevin Durant when he went to Seattle and then essentially being the face of the franchise in Oklahoma City, and people were wondering, well, where is his career going to go? And like, it just took off, and now Oklahoma City is this niche organization where, like, hey, like this little town that could potentially really win an NBA championship. So maybe Trey Burke could do that. But then we also see things like being in Siberia, like the Sacramento Kings organization. You just go there and your career turns into a bit of a wasteland because it's an inept organization. You've got shaky coaching. Your talent pool is bereft of anything that is considered hope and promise. And all of a sudden, you see someone like Tyreke Evans is like, what happened to that guy? Now, Tyreke Evans did get $11 million on the open market, but that's another conversation for another day as well. So
my example of that in recent times is Michael Kidd-Gilchrist going to Charlotte, but my all-time one was the one that always made me really sad, was Sean Livingston going to the Clippers back when the Clippers were what we all think of them as.
Right.
But to me, the thing that's really kind of irritating about that part of the process is not that really that a guy starts there, but that the team has complete control over their second contract. So if you have a guy, let's say Kyrie Irving is pretty much unquestionably, unless he gets hurt a million more times, a max contract guy. So if assuming that he's going to spend the first 8 years of his career in Cleveland or wherever Cleveland wants to send him, because he has no control over that, unless he is willing to bite the bullet and take the qualifying offer and then go somewhere as an unrestricted free agent. So take the huge financial risk of that. And so, like, you look at guys, you know, Kevin Love is going to be – he went 1 year in college. He's going to be I think he'll be turning 27 before he gets the chance to choose his own team.
Yep. Well, and I think LeBron is the biggest example of that. And people want to say he betrayed Cleveland and he did all these things. But LeBron James gave 7 years to Cleveland. And people forget, like, that was 7 years of Cleveland being, you know, one of the original Siberia-like teams in the NBA to being a profile, being a headlining organization, and then he left and it went all down to, you know, hell in a handbasket. But, you know, he already knew if he wanted to set up his money the right way that he was going to have to give him a second contract. And that, I think that's the interesting thing, is that if you're a good player and you show promise, the organization has every opportunity to show you that, hey, we're going to try to build around you. And we saw that with LeBron. We saw that with Carmelo. We saw that with Dwayne Wade. We're seeing it now with Oklahoma City with Durant and Curry and Rondo and some of these guys. But then you see guys like John Wall or DeMarcus Cousins, where they get finished with their first contract and the organization is really shaky. Like, I'm not sure if we want to give you this deal. Now, they ended up giving him the deal, right? But there was a lot of trepidation and hesitation when it came along with that. And you look at where Washington and Sacramento is right now, and you probably have some second-guessing going on, saying, well, should we have given John Wall did he get a max contract or a near-max contract for basically putting up, you know, a 22-7-4 line for 2 months at the end of the season? Like, that's the reason why, you know, you want to give him a max contract. Like, has he really proven enough to show that he deserves that? And I think the same thing with DeMarcus Cousins, just showing that he's got all the talent. And these are tough decisions for organizations to make. Now, Danny, I would say that it was intriguing to see what Minnesota did with Pekovic, because they let the market bear out what they're going to be willing to pay him, because they have the final say on will we sign this guy or not, and will anybody make an offer if they hit restricted free agency. And Pekovic was a restricted free agent. He was out there forever. At some point, I was like, man, Oklahoma City, just do it. But I'm a homer, and I'm selfish, and I'm just like, I just want us to have everybody. But he was sitting right there to be bid on. And who knows, maybe Minnesota would have just, you know, re-upped on any offer that was put up for Pekovic. But I would say that Minnesota got Pekovic on a deal. Do you know what those final numbers were for Pekovic's deal?
I can pull it up. Josh Smith was on the market, and he just – basically nobody bid on him because – it's such an advantageous position to be the team. And that's the reason why I was so critical of the Cousins and Wall extensions, was because the system is so stacked in favor of the drafting team when a guy's a first-round pick that they had all the leverage even if they waited a year. Unless a guy could faithfully convince a team that he's willing to pull the Ben Gordon and sign the qualifying offer and then be able to leave, there's no reason for a team to do that. So Pekovic got 5 years, $60 million. So that's a lot, but not an insane amount for him.
Right. And I think if he was on the market right now, his number would probably edge closer to $15 million, I'd say. I think that'd be fair. You know. So
yeah, he's a lot younger than Bogut.
Exactly. And Bogut ended up getting what, 3 years and what, 44 or something to that degree?
I think he got 336, but then incentives could push it up to 42.
I got you.
I think that it's in that range. But yeah, I mean, but Pekovic is substantially younger, and he doesn't have the injury history that made Bogut so shaky. I mean, the reason that the Bucks, I don't know if you could call it giving up on him. I mean, that's how I interpret trading Monty Ellis at that time. But the reason wasn't that they didn't think he was going to be a good player. It's that they never thought he was going to be healthy.
Right.
And that was a justifiable opinion from where they were and the Warriors, but in that situation, and I think that was a great example of the difference between the power of restricted free agency and unrestricted, is that my feeling on this, and I wrote about it a little bit, was that the Warriors had to be legitimately scared that Bogut was going to leave, because whether or not it was justified that he felt hurt by them going after Dwight Howard, he was an unrestricted free agent, so he could go wherever he wanted, and there was nothing they could do. If he decided, I want to go to the Lakers for the minimum, they could do that. If he wants to go to Dallas for the maximum, he can do that. And so because of that, and because of the fact that they didn't have the cap space to find somebody else if they lost him because of the way that the CBA is structured, they freaked out and basically gave him a contract that I think you can justify for both sides, because they saw that ramification. But guys like John Wall, the team didn't have that, because worst comes to worst, you just sign him for the same deal next year.
Agreed 100%.
Let's talk a little bit about your Thunder. Do you think that this team, as presently constituted, can win a championship in the next 2 years?
In the next 2 years? That's interesting that you put that time frame on this team. I actually think that, as presently constructed, this team could win an NBA championship this year or next year. Now, the likelihood, I think, isn't as high as we'd like it to be. But look, I think this year, this team is pretty much the team that they are, unless they decide that the first-round draft picks that they have stored as assets, the young talent that they have, and they decide that one of them might be expendable, if that's Reggie Jackson, Jeremy Lamb, Perry Jones III, whoever, which is funny, because you notice the player I didn't say was Steven Adams. He is probably the least expendable player on the Thunder. That's, you know, a newly acquired draft pick. They're not giving up on Steven Adams at all. So, like, if anybody calls for him, The answer is going to be quickly no, I would imagine. So, you know, if they decide, which I would personally maybe not have a problem with, they decide, hey, look, we're going to package, you know, PJ3 and a first-round pick and maybe, you know, another player to say we're going to upgrade at the wing position or we're going to upgrade in the front court, then I think that could be something pretty interesting for Oklahoma City. I've even heard some people say that, hey, Oklahoma City should consider making a run for Danny Granger. And I'm just like, I don't see where that money is going to come from to get him. But if Danny Granger somehow lands on Oklahoma City, I'm not going to stop it. And I think that would be an intriguing move. I think they'd probably have to give up Perkins to get him. And if I have no idea why Indiana would ever want Perkins, so I don't think that trade's ever going to happen. But here's the thing. Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook are still getting better. Serge Ibaka is still getting better. We keep forgetting that these guys are still 25, 24, and 24 years of age. But I think every single day, the seat is going to continue to get hotter on Scott Brooks, because I've just decided that I think Kevin Durant is the Eeyore of the NBA, because he always looks miserable. When we were in the arena at Oracle for Oklahoma City versus Golden State, I mean, good Lord, I saw Reggie Jackson looking off Kevin Durant. I saw Serge Ibaka looking off Kevin Durant. The only person on that team that has earned the right to look off Kevin Durant is Russell Westbrook. And ladies and gentlemen, you all know the scorn and the slander and ridicule that you guys have given Russell, I made up his middle name, but I want it to be Geronimo Westbrook, for doing the things that he's done on the court. But look, he's earned it. And there's so much hatred that goes to Westbrook, but he's earned his right to say, hey, look, I can make a play. But Reggie Jackson hasn't earned that right. Serge Ibaka hasn't earned that right. Jeremy Lamb hasn't earned that right. And Kevin Durant looks miserable playing basketball sometimes. And it is a terrible thing to watch. And Scott Brooks has not proven to me that he knows how to solve these types of situations. And I always there's always this belief in the back of my mind that the Oklahoma City are winning in spite of Scott Brooks instead of because of Scott Brooks. And that's the thing we used to think about Eric Spoelstra. But I think over time, we've seen Spoelstra do things to put Miami in situations to win, even if it's just lineup changes, even if it's just slight tweaks to the scheme. And putting players in certain positions, putting Battier in a corner, or putting LeBron on the block, or giving Dwayne Wade more rest. Little moves that you don't see those subtleties happen with Oklahoma City at all. In fact, I think actually Oklahoma City, if anything, they have become more predictable, and I think it's made them more susceptible to losses against teams they have no business losing to. But I think that's hurt them more so. That's the only thing that scares me more so in the playoffs is that, you know, you can only play isolation ball so much. And even if you have Westbrook and Durant to do those things, and then you can kick it out to Serge Ibaka for a 17-footer, like, how far is that really going to take you? And, like, at this point, they really need Reggie Jackson to be, you know, Reggie Jackson has turned himself into Westbrook, you know, Jr., which is kind of hilarious. But he's become that type of guy. They need Jeremy Lamb to be a spot-up three-point shooter. Good Lord, like, that's a scary sight to behold. They need Derek Fisher to be a knockdown three-point shooter. They need Steven Adams to be able to play 20 minutes and be a sufficient big man. And so when you start putting those things into the formula, then it starts to get a little scary. But the only caveat to all those things I said is I think the West is still very much up for grabs. And as great as San Antonio looks right now, and you see how Portland is shooting, like, 97% from three-point land right now. Clippers are still going to get better. Houston's going to get better. Golden State they look awesome. But Oklahoma City, I think, is still right there.
It's interesting that you brought up Spoelstra, because to me, the defining characteristic of Spoelstra is his willingness to try almost anything to see if it works. Yep. And the defining characteristic of Scottie Brooks is his stubbornness. Almost no other coach, given the tools that they have, would still be playing Derek Fisher, would still even have him on the roster as a guy who plays as opposed to being like an assistant coach. And he was stubborn with Perkins. I mean, it took Perkins' injury for him to really play Adams very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt for about 2 years now that the real ceiling for Oklahoma City is their ownership's apparent unwillingness to pay the luxury tax, but their other ceiling is Scottie Brooks, because he just doesn't seem like he has the interest or desire or whatever it is to try a bunch of stuff, throw a bunch of stuff to the wall and see what sticks. It's kind of the idea of, for me, of a guy who kind of, he had a move that worked for him in high school, and so he's going to stick with it until somebody stops him, but it works well enough that it's like, okay, I'm going to keep rolling with that.
Well, I only agree to a degree. I will say he's tried some things. I thought it's been interesting to see him put a lineup out there with, like, Westbrook or Jackson at the point, and he's basically going Durant, PJ3, Ibaka, and Perkins or Adams on the front line, which has been interesting to watch, to say the least. I will say that it's interesting to see how much freedom he's given Reggie Jackson and Jeremy Lamb. I mean, he's letting Reggie Jackson be Russell Westbrook, and it's netted some results to the point that Reggie Jackson might have to start being considered as a potential sixth man of the year. Like, I don't think he's there yet, but I think he's starting to get himself in that conversation, you know, which is a boon for Oklahoma City, definitely. I also, but I think some of the finger might have to be pointed more at Sam Presti than Scott Brooks, too. I think it deserves to be pointed at Brooks, but I just think if you start looking at the makeup of this roster, it's one thing to accumulate talent, but it's another thing to accumulate the right talent. And if you have someone like Reggie Jackson, do you need him to be Westbrook-like? If you have someone like Jeremy Lamb, who's a ball-dominant guard who's great at slashing, does he benefit being on this team more so than maybe a shooter like Wesley Matthews? And I know Wesley Matthews is established, but the type of player like Wesley Matthews who has a slightly different skill set. And I think with, you know, when you're accumulating assets, you sometimes, you know, you worry about getting the best talent first and then you sort out and just do with it later on. But at this point, they are in a position where they're in their championship window. And I don't think that's anything blasphemous to say. And I think, you know, everybody's already, you know, when James Harden left for Houston, people are like, oh, it's going to come real quick that, you know, Kevin Durant is going to go to Washington, D.C., or he's going to go to Houston to go to Harden. Like, they're already thinking about ways of getting Kevin Durant out of Oklahoma City, and they're already trying to think of ways to get Russell Westbrook to go to L.A. to pair up with Kevin Love and go play for the Clippers or the Lakers. Like, these conversations are already happening, and I don't think that Sam Presti is worried about reading those press clippings, but what I would say is that Sam Presti has to be concerned about keeping Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook happy. And if they're not, and to your point, you mentioned something about being willing to spend over the tax. I have always looked at it like, I don't necessarily think they're not unwilling to spend over the tax, but I think there is something that is really restrictive with this salary cap where you don't want to double dip into the tax. And I think they look at the way this roster is currently built and they're trying to do whatever it is in their power to not double dip this year so that next year they can spend more and then the year following they can spend more. And then they're also going to have Perkins coming out the books. And they're gonna have to probably replace Cephalosha, and they're probably gonna have to replace Collison, and those things are gonna cost money. So you could call it money management, but the Oklahoma City's not the only team having to deal with these issues. But they're probably the most high profile team that has to deal with this issue, and I think that's why the criticism's going squarely on the ownership of the Thunder.
It's interesting. I was just a random thought, but I think it's relevant. We've been talking about coaches and teams and systems. To me, I've thought about this, and you follow the Eastern Conference, so I can feel comfortable asking you this. Is there a reason why we think that Mike Brown is a good NBA head coach?
He is. the pundits and the prognosticators have told us that Mike Brown is a good defensive coach. He came of the Greg Popovich school of hard knocks. And when he was in Cleveland, he definitely had a strong defensive unit. It also helps to have people like Varejao Allen, LeBron on your roster who can play really good defense. And they had a ton of people who could rebound. They had Ben Wallace on that squad, so on and so forth. And then when he was at the Lake, well, I guess the Lakers probably isn't a great example. But anyway, he's shown that statistically he's been able to put a strong defensive unit out there. I think that's been his calling card. Now, you're also asking this man to turn water into wine with the talent that he's got on Cleveland right now, and I don't know if and I don't know if he's got anybody there that really wants to play defense, because I think, you know, Varejao has actually been really inconsistent this year. And Kyrie Irving is challenging Damian Lillard and James Harden as the worst defending guard in the NBA. Deion Waiters is Deion Waiters. You know, Tristan Thompson is a sufficient defensive big man, but he's nobody he's going to call and tell your mama about. And I couldn't name a small forward on the Cleveland Cavaliers right now. From a talent standpoint, they are struggling still. And, you know, they're better than they were a year ago, but I don't necessarily want to criticize Mike Brown for having a struggling defensive unit. And, of course, he was never known to be praised for his offense. So I'm just going to say that right now they've got a coach in there that the ownership is familiar with. They're really going to tell Mike Brown. They're telling Mike Brown to hold the line and don't embarrass us too much. And let's see if we can continue to build in the coming years. And if he gets to a point that Scott Brooks got to, or Spoelstra got to, or Frank Vogel, I think ownership now, they're really willing to take chances on fresh, young, new coaches. But then if the talent proves that it's either too much for them and they can't handle it, or that they can grow with that coach, then they will. But I think they're going to give Mike Brown every opportunity to exhaust that opportunity before they decide to go elsewhere.
Here's why I asked the question.
Go ahead.
If I'm LeBron James,
yep,
and I'm looking, and to me, he left Cleveland for a completely logical reason. Whether if you want to argue about how he did it, I think how he did it was unbelievably bad. But if you had given any of us the opportunity at 25 years old or younger to make that decision, we'd do about the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think of that he left for a logical reason, that they were having trouble procuring talent, and whether or not he thought they were mismanaged, then the job of Cleveland in the last, since he left, was to show him why you're a changed team and why he can take you back in that sense. And so hiring Mike Brown, who, while he was praised at the time that he won Coach of the Year. And I think it was part of the reason he won Coach of the Year is because none of us realized how amazing LeBron James was. And that once he kind of got more, if you want to call it unleashed, whatever you want to call it, once he got maximized, he became an even better player. Some of that was being around better talent. But regardless, the point to me is that if you're trying to go to him and say, hey, we're a better organization now, you know, obviously they have the same owner, so that's not a part of it, but you know, we can do this around you, and that when you looked at their last decision was hiring the same coach that they fired the last time, why should he have faith that they're any better than they were then, except for having Kyrie?
Well, I agree with you with everything you said, but I think there's something else that we're totally missing out with the Cleveland organization, which I think would deter LeBron to go there. Is just look at the last three drafts they've had. The Cleveland Cavaliers drafted Tristan Thompson, Deion Waiters, and Anthony Bennett. And let's just play what if for 5 seconds. If you said the Cleveland Cavaliers' current roster is Kyrie Irving, Tristan Thompson, Deion Waiters, and Anthony Bennett as young emerging talent versus, hey, I have Kyrie Irving, Jonas Valanciunas, I have Harrison Barnes, and I have Victor Oladipo on that same roster, that becomes a lot more appealing for LeBron, whoever the coach is. Because if LeBron's like, I want to come to Cleveland, they'll get the coach out of there if they ask him. Like, it's one of those things, like, they will bite the bullet to make LeBron happy. But I think LeBron's going to look at that roster and say, what the hell is Anthony Bennett? Is he what is this player? What are you going to do with him? Tristan Thompson can't make his mind up if he wants to shoot with his right hand or his left hand. And Deion Waiters may or may not have punched a star player in the face. Like, I just don't know if LeBron wants those types of problems, which we really might be giving Cleveland a major pass, Danny. Look at those three picks I just named, and look at people that are immediately below them. And you start wondering, how much did they really whiff? Because Cleveland could be building something that Golden State and Oklahoma City couldn't even dream of. Now, you also could say, look, if they draft Valanciunas, if they draft Harrison Barnes, maybe they don't have a chance to get the number one pick. These things are all variables, and I get it. But I think it's hard to question that they missed compared to the other players that were below on the draft board. And along with the type of roster moves they've made, which they really haven't made any roster moves outside of Jarrett Jack, which I think was the best signing they've made. They gave Earl Clark some money. They still have never drafted a small – they have never acquired a small forward worth a damn. I think he's just going to look at Cleveland and be like, I'm not going there. And I think it's almost a pipe dream to say that he does. And I think the coach is like the least of the concerns.
You bring up an excellent point with the draft. There's an amazing narrative there that in three drafts in a row, they passed on elite center players to draft players who play positions that are generally considered less valuable. They passed on Jonas to take Tristan Thompson.
Yep.
They passed on Drummond to take Waiters.
Yep.
And then they passed on Noel to take Anthony Bennett. And they traded up in the middle of those 3 years to get Tyler Zeller.
Yep.
So what you're looking at to me is an organization. That's why I ranked them towards the bottom. I think they were like third from the bottom in my offseason rankings, because I graded on a curve based on the resources you have. And they had the number one pick, and they got a guy who has upside. I'm not going to say that Anthony Bennett doesn't, but if your goal is to get LeBron, if you're basically to me, if you're Cleveland, since LeBron James left, and you saw that you weren't even able to get free agents to come there when you had the best player in the league, the best young player in the league, who guys are flocking with now, taking the minimum to play with,
yep,
that if you can't get guys like that, then your whole job as an organization is to spend the next 4 years making it so that he'll want to come back. Because he's your best chance, because there just aren't many great players that come from there. They have a pull with him that no other team has. Like, L.A. has the benefit with Kevin Love and Russell Westbrook of being like, oh, this is where you went to college, Westbrook, that's where he's from. And, hey, it's also a big media market. Hey, it's also all the stuff with Cleveland. They have to go after the guys who it's home for, because that's who you do. And so to do that and then to whiff as badly as they did, that's a separate issue. But then to take your last pick and say, hey, you know what? When we're trying to get the last guy to convince this guy to come here this summer, we're going to take a project. We're going to take a guy who you're going to have to say, you're going to have to be looking off into the distance and saying, hey, in 3 years or 2 years, this guy's going to be really good. That was a strange tactical decision.
Yeah, and Cleveland has never seemed to be the type that it makes strong tactical decisions, at least not in the last 20 years. So I think the days of LeBron in Miami will continue, and, you know, God bless Cleveland. I hate to say, I've been there. Danny LaRue, have you been to Cleveland before?
I have, actually. I have family right around there.
Okay. Do you ever go visit them?
I've been there twice ever.
Yeah. I can tell clearly you've not been motivated to go back anytime soon. So, yeah, God bless Cleveland. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Yeah, I love Cleveland. I just think that it's hard for them, and I think that this is, to me, the great kind of truth in the league is that there's a group of teams that are going to have trouble getting free agents. And so what they have to do is they have different rules that apply to them. And I think at the same point, you can say that there are different rules that apply to New York and LA. And so what you have to do is you have to understand what the constraints that you're playing under a given CBA, obviously they can change. And then you work your butt off to maximize with that. I think the classic example of that was Houston. Houston knew that the only way that they could get an elite talent was by either retaining somebody that they already had, so what they ended up doing with Harden, or somebody they drafted conceptually, or they could have enough space for one guy and make a team so good that they could pull one guy who wasn't happy where he was. So Houston's like, okay, this is how we can do it. They did it and it got done. Cleveland's never really, and a lot of other teams have never really embraced their situation to maximize from that.
Yeah, I agree. And to be fair, like, I think, you know, Daryl Morey at some point at Houston was under the microscope. I think 2 years ago, was it last year, maybe 2 years ago, you know, they had this talent. They had a bunch of guys that, you know, were, you know, Morey ball guys almost. You know, they were finding value, right? But they kept whiffing on getting talent. And really, you know, James Harden fell into their lap. I think it was almost a freak incident that they got James Harden. That wasn't something that they had been planning for a long time, but they put themselves in a situation so that if something like that were to occur, that they could take advantage of it. It's not that much different than, say, what the then New Jersey Nets did with Utah. Utah decided that, hey, we don't see this thing going forward with Deron Williams going all that well. Who's a team that can give us some immediate assets that we can continue to move forward with? And the Nets were like, hey, we'll give you Derek Favors and a draft pick and blah, blah, blah. And the trade went, all of a sudden happened, and the Nets were now a benefactor of being a legitimate Eastern Conference player. And the same thing happened with Harden. And now when they got Harden, they have Dwight. I will say, Danny, I think it's interesting because you look at teams like Portland, right? Or you look at teams like, you know, Cleveland, I thought could have been that team, right? Or you look at a team like Detroit a year ago who, you know, you look at Portland, they've kind of been slow and steady to continue to use our talent, listen, continue to build in-house. And you look at Detroit and they're like, well, we got this money. We got new money. Let's spend it. Let's bring in Josh. Let's bring in Brandon, whoever. And I think you have to start thinking about this road of patience. And Cleveland, I think it's trying to play the road of patience. They're trying to go down this patient road. But they've took so many missteps with their draft picks that they're not in a great position right now. Now, I'm not saying it can't get better, but they're not in the greatest of positions. And I think Houston's now in a point where they still got a couple of moves left because it seems like everybody's convinced that a Sheik could be traded soon. Now, side note to all of that, I think it would be potentially awesome to see a three-way trade with, like, Houston and Indiana and New Orleans. So somehow, some way, maybe Danny Granger leaves Indiana, you put a Sheik on a team like New Orleans, and you see a team like Indiana, like Houston, get someone like Ryan Anderson or Eric Gordon or something like that, and you see those pieces move around. And that's just really hypothetical. I don't even know if that works in a trade machine. I'm not the Bill Simmons trade machine guy. But Houston still got moves to make, and they still got assets. They still got Terrence Jones over there. They still got draft picks that are they still yet to use, I believe. So I don't know, Danny. I mean, I'm jealous of Houston now, and I think a lot of other teams are too, definitely.
The last thing with Houston that I think is really interesting is that they also benefited pretty substantially in terms of how things ended up from the Chris Paul trade getting vetoed.
Absolutely.
And so you think about that in a relatively short span, that they get a trade that would have been good for them. I understand why they were frustrated that it got vetoed in the short term, but in the long term allowed them to retain the assets that they used to get Harden without losing the flexibility to get Dwight. And then having a series of teams turn down offers that now they would take in a heartbeat for Harden. And so they're like, okay, we have this offer. It's a pretty good offer. You know, it was a justifiable thing if ownership said you have to trade him now to do that. And so to get those circumstances, but you know, John Wooden always says success is where preparation meets opportunity. They were prepared with the resources and they got the opportunity twice and they capitalized. And so I think that's the model in some ways for teams is, you know, build your stuff up and understand what you are, embrace what you are, and do your best to get guys in the draft and hope that you can get somebody there.
Agreed, 100%.
Okay, well, thank you so much for taking the time. It was a pleasure.
Indeed. Definitely looking forward to hopping on again, man. Great show, as always, and more luck and power to you moving forward, sir.
Take care.
All right, man.
Thanks again to Ed for coming on. You can read him on Sports Fan Journal, his SB Nation column, Happy Hour, and you can read him in Slam Magazine. You can also follow him on Twitter. His handle is @EdTheSportsFan. You can also read Sham Sharania on Real GM, and his Twitter handle is his name. Appreciate having both of them on. Looking forward to the next couple weeks of guests, and also looking forward to having a theme song. I have it. It's already picked out. It's already done. But we haven't dotted the I's and crossed the T's on the contract, so that's why it's not in this issue. You can look forward to that next time. And again, I appreciate any insight that can make the show better. You can send it to me at daniel.larue@realgm.com, or it'd be better to send it to my Twitter handle, which is @DannyLarue, DannyLeroux. Thank you so much for listening, and make it a great day.